You just need to know where to look. She glimpses her own face once, while splashing water on it in the bathroom of a service station near a national forest in a state where she's the merest beginner. She looks marvelously weathered, old beyond her years. She has gone to seed. Soon she'll start to scare people. Well, she has always scared people. Angry people who hated wildness took away her career. Frightened people mocked her for saying that trees send messages to each other. She forgives them all. It's nothing. What frightens people most will one day turn to wonder. And then people will do what 4 billion years have shaped them to do. Stop and see just what it is they're seeing. On a late fall afternoon, she pulls her ancient beater over to the side of the road along a stretch of the Fish Lake Scenic Byway on the western edge of the Colorado Plateau in south-central Utah. She has followed back roads from Las Vegas, capital of clueless sinners, towards Salt Lake, capital of cunning saints. She gets out of the car and walks up into the trees on the crest west of the road. Aspens stand in the afternoon sun, spreading along the ridge out of sight. Populus tremuloides. Clouds of gold leaf glint on thin trunks tinted the palest green. The air is still, but the aspens shake as if in a wind. Aspens alone quake, when all others stand in dead calm. Long, flattened leaf stalks twist at the slightest gust, and all around her, a million two-toned cadmium mirrors flicker against righteous blue. The oracle leaves turn the wind audible. They filter the dry light and fill it with expectation. Trunks run straight and bare, roughed with age at the bottom, then smooth and whitening up to the first branches. Circles of pale green lichen pallet spatter them. She stands inside this white-gray room, a pillared foyer to the afterlife. The air shivers in gold, and the ground is littered with windfall and dead ramets. The ridge smells wide open and sear. The whole atmosphere is as good as a running mountain stream. Patricia Westerford hugs herself, and for no reason begins to cry. The tree of the Navajo sunhouse chant. The tree Hercules turned into a wreath. The one he sacrificed when coming back from hell. The one whose brood leaves protected native hunters from evil. This, the most widely distributed tree in North America, with close kin on 3 continents, all at once feels unbearably rare. She has hiked through aspens far north into Canada, the lone hardwood holdout in a latitude monotonous with conifer, has sketched their pale summer shades throughout New England and the upper Midwest, has camped among them on hot, dry outcrops above gushing streams of snowmelt in the Rockies, has found them etched with knowledge-encoded native arbor glyphs, has lain on her back with her eyes closed in far southwestern mountains, memorizing the tone of that restless shudder. Picking her way across these fallen branches, she hears it again. No other tree makes this sound. The aspens wave in their undetectable breeze, and she begins to see hidden things. High up on one trunk, she reads claw gashes above her head, the cryptic writing of bears. But these slashes are old and rimmed with blackened scars. No bears have crossed these woods in a long time. Tangled roots spill from the banks of a rivulet. She studies them, the exposed edge of a network of underground conduits conducting water and minerals across dozens of acres, up the rise to other seemingly separate stems that line the rocky outcrops where water is hard to find. At the height of the rise is a little clearing, slashed down with a chainsaw. Someone has been out improving things. She produces her loop from her keychain and applies it to one stump to estimate the number of rings. The oldest downed trees are about 80 years. She smiles at the number, so comical. For these 50,000 baby trees all around her have sprouted from a rhizome mass too old to date even to the nearest 100 millennia. Underground, the 80-year-old trunks are 100,000 if they're a day. She wouldn't be surprised if this great, joined, single, clonal creature that looks like a forest has been around for the better part of 1 million years. That's why she has stopped, to see one of the oldest, largest living things on Earth. All around her spreads one single male, whose genetically identical trunks cover more than 100 acres. The thing is outlandish, beyond her ability to wrap her head around. But then, as Dr. Westerford knows, the world's outlands are everywhere, and trees like to toy with human thought like boys toy with beetles. Across the road from where she's parked, aspens tumble down the basin toward Fish Lake, where 5 years earlier a Chinese refugee engineer took his 3 daughters camping on the way to visiting Yellowstone. The oldest girl, named for a Puccini opera heroine, will soon be wanted by the feds for $50 million of arson. 2,000 miles to the east, a student sculptor born into an Iowa farming family on a pilgrimage to the Met walks past the single quaking aspen in all of Central Park and doesn't notice it. He'll live to walk past the tree again 30 years later, but only because of swearing to the Puccini heroine that no matter how bad things get, he won't kill himself. To the north, up the curving spine of the Rockies, on a farm near Idaho Falls, a veteran airman, that very afternoon, builds horse stalls for a friend from his old squadron. It's a pity hire, one that comes with room and board, and the vet plans to leave the gig as soon as he can. But for today, he makes the corral siding out of aspen. As poor as the wood is for lumber, it won't shatter when a horse kicks it. In a St. Paul suburb not far from Lake Elmo, 2 aspens grow near the south wall of an intellectual property lawyer's house. He's only dimly aware of them, and when his free-spirit girlfriend asks, he tells her they're birches. In time, 2 great strokes will lay the lawyer low, reducing all aspens, birches, beeches, pines, oaks, and maples to a single word that will take him 1/2 minute to pronounce. On the West Coast, in the emerging Silicon Valley, a Gujarati-American boy and his father build primitive aspens out of chunky black-and-white pixels. They're writing a game that feels to the boy like walking through the forest primeval. These people are nothing to Plant Patty, and yet their lives have long been connected, deep underground. Their kinship will work like an unfolding book. The past always comes clearer in the future. Years from now, she'll write a book of her own, The Secret Forest. Its opening page will read, "You and the tree in your backyard come from a common ancestor. 1.5 billion years ago, the two of you parted ways. But even now, after an immense journey in separate directions, that tree and you still share 1/4 of your genes." She stands in the clearing at the top of the rise, looking out over a shallow gully. Aspens everywhere, and it boggles her mind that not one of them has grown from seed. All through this part of the West, Few aspens have done so in 10,000 years. Long ago, the climate changed, and an aspen's seeds can no longer thrive here. But they propagate by root. They spread. There are aspen colonies up north where the ice sheets were, older than the sheets themselves. The motionless trees are migrating. Immortal stands of aspen retreating before the latest 2-mile-thick glaciers, then following them back north again. Life will not answer to reason, and meaning is too young a thing to have much power over it. All the drama of the world is gathering underground. Massed symphonic choruses that Patricia means to hear before she dies. She looks out over the draw to guess which way her male, this giant aspen clone, might be headed. He has been roving around the hills and gullies in a 10-millennium search for a female quaking giant to fertilize. Something on the next rise punches her in the chest. Carved out from the heart of the spreading clone, a housing development sits among a ribbon of new roads. Condos, a few days old, cut through several acres of the root system of one of the Earth's most lavish things. Dr. Westerford closes her eyes. She has seen dieback across the west. Aspens are withering, grazed on by everything with hooves, cut off from rejuvenating fire. Whole groves are vanishing. Now she sees a forest spreading across these mountains since before humans left Africa, giving way to second homes. She sees it in one great glimpse of flashing gold. Trees and humans, at war over the land and water and atmosphere. And she can hear, louder than the quaking leaves, which side will lose by winning. In the early 80s, Patricia heads northwest. Giants still grow in the lower 48, pockets of old growth scattered from Northern California on up to Washington. She means to see what uncut forests look like, while there is any left to see. The Western Cascades in a damp September. Nothing in her experience prepares her. From mid-distance, with no clue for scale, the trees seem no larger than the biggest sycamores and tulip poplars out east. But up close, the illusion disappears, and she's lost in reasons opposite. All she can do is look and laugh and look some more. Hemlock, grand fir, yellow cedar, Douglas fir, buttressed monster conifers disappear in the mist above her. Sitka spruces bulge out in burls as big as minivans. Pound for pound, a wood stronger than steel. A single trunk could fill a large logging truck. Even runts here are big enough to dominate an eastern forest, and each acre holds at least 5 times as much wood. Beneath these giants, way down in the understory, her own body seems freakishly small, like one of those acorn people she made in childhood. A knothole in one of these columns of solidified air could be her home. Clicks and chatter disturb the cathedral hush. The air is so twilight green, she feels like she's underwater. It rains particles, spore clouds, broken webs and mammal dander, skeletonized mites, bits of insect frass and bird feather. Everything climbs over everything else, fighting for scraps of light. If she holds still too long, vines will overrun her. She walks in silence, crunching 10,000 invertebrates with every step, watching for tracks in a place where at least one of the native languages uses the same word for footprint and understanding. The earth gives beneath her like a shot mattress. An exposed ridge takes her down into a basin. She swings her singing stick before her, and the temperature plummets as she passes through a thermal curtain. The canopy is a colander stippling the beetle-swarmed surfaces with specks of sun. For every large trunk, a few hundred seedlings huddle in the litter. Sword fern, liverworts, lichen, and leaves as small as sand grains stain every inch of the dank, downed logs. The mosses are themselves as dense as thumbnail forests. She presses on fissures of bark, and her fingers sink in knuckle deep. A bit of bushwhacking reveals the extent of the prodigious rot. Crumbling, creature-riddled bowls, decaying for centuries. Snags, gothic and twisted, silvery as inverted icicles. She has never inhaled such fecund putrefaction. The sheer mass of ever-dying life, packed into each single cubic foot, woven together with fungal filaments and dew-betrayed spiderweb, leaves her woozy. Mushrooms ladder up the sides of trunks in terraced ledges. Dead salmon feed the trees. Soaked by fog all winter long, spongy green stuff she can't name covers every wooden pillar in thick bays reaching higher than her head. Death is everywhere, oppressive and beautiful. She sees the source of that forestry doctrine she so resisted in school. Looking at all this glorious decay, a person might be forgiven for thinking that old meant decadent, that such thick mats of decomposition were cellulose cemeteries in need of the rejuvenating axe. She sees why her kind will always dread these close, choked thickets, where the beauty of solo trees gives way to something massed, scary, and crazed. When the fable turns dark, when the slasher film builds to primal horror, this is where the doomed children and wayward adolescents must wander. There are things in here worse than wolves and witches, primal fears that no amount of civilizing will ever tame. The prodigious forest pulls her along, past the trunk of an immense western red cedar. Her hand strokes the fibrous strips that peel from a fluted trunk whose girth rivals the height of an eastern dogwood. It reeks of incense. The top has sheared off, replaced by a candelabra of boughs promoted to stand in trunks. A grotto opens at ground level in the rotted heartwood. Whole families of mammals could live inside it. But the branches, a thousand years on, drooping with scaly sprays a dozen stories above her, are still crammed full of cones. She addresses the cedar, using words of the forest's first humans. Long life maker, I'm here, down here. She feels foolish at first, but each word is a little easier than the next. Thank you for the baskets and the boxes. Thank you for the capes and hats and skirts. Thank you for the cradles, the beds, the diapers, canoes, paddles, harpoons and nets, poles, logs, posts, the rot-proof shakes and shingles, the kindling that will always light. Each new item is release and relief. Finding no good reason to quit now, she lets the gratitude spill out. Thank you for the tools, the chests, the decking, the clothes closets, the paneling. I forget. Thank you, she says, following the ancient formula, for all these gifts that you have given. And still not knowing how to stop, she adds, We're sorry. We didn't know how hard it is for you to grow back. She finds work with the Bureau of Land Management. Wilderness Ranger. The job description seems as miraculous as the outsized trees. Help preserve and protect, for present and future generations, places where man is a visitor who does not remain. The wild woman must don a uniform, but they pay her to be by herself, carry the welcome weight of a pack, read a topographic map, dig a water bar, look for smoke and fire, teach folks to leave no trace, follow the rhythms of the land, and live wholly within the arc of the year. To clean up after humankind, yes, to gather the endless twisties, baggies, six-pack rings, foil, cans, and bottle caps strewn through meadows of wildflower, on remote scenic outlooks, skewered in the boughs of noble firs, under cold running streams, behind waterfalls. She would gladly pay the government to do that much. Her supervisor apologizes for the state of the cabin they give her, on the edge of an ancient cedar grove. There's no running water, and the varmints outweigh the new biped in biomass many times over. She can only laugh.
"You don't understand. You don't understand. It's the Alhambra."
Tomorrow, she'll hike 25 miles, loosening the bolts on the signs attached to trailside trees, so their cambium can keep growing. There's a spot on the other side of the ridge where the bark of a big spruce has swallowed an old Forest Service plaque from the 40s that now says only, "Beware of." The nightly rain starts. She goes out to the clearing and sits in the downpour, dressed only in a loose cotton shirt, listening to the wood put forth fresh cells. She comes back inside. In the kitchen, she lights the kerosene lamp with chunky, strike-anywhere matches, and takes the flame into the bedroom. The thump of a bushy-tailed wood rat telegraphs another raid on her worthless belongings. Last week it was a pair of barrettes. Too dark to search for the latest missing loot tonight. She sponges off over the cold water zinc basin in the corner and gets in bed. No sooner does her ear listen in to the musty pillow than she's transported to the ancestral vacation home where the future still radiates endless forms most beautiful. She works for 11 blissful months. The wildlife never once threatens her, and deranged campers do so only twice. In the constant rain, everything grows mold. Monster trees suck up the downpour and respire it back into the air as steam. Spores spread across every damp surface. Both her legs sport athlete's foot up to the knees. Sometimes, when she lies down and closes her eyes, she feels that moss will cover her lids by the time she opens them again. She labors for days to make a storage pad, hacking back the brush from a few square feet. By year's end, the little nick in the undergrowth is covered again in shrub and saplings. She loves feeling that every headway man tries to make into the relentless green blitz will be crushed. Unknown to her, while she rehabs backcountry fire rings and cleans up illegal campsites fouled with beer cans and toilet paper, an article appears. It's published in a reputable journal, one of the best that humankind has managed. "Trees trade airborne aerosol signals," the article says. "They make medicines. Their fragrances alert and awaken their neighbors. They can sense an attacking species and summon an air force to come to their aid." The authors cite her earlier much-mocked article. They reproduce her findings and extend them into surprising places. Words of hers that she has all but forgotten have gone on drifting out on the open air, lighting up others like a waft of pheromones. Patricia is out one day in an unfamiliar drainage, sawing windthrow from a remote trail. She sees a motion in the undergrowth, the most dangerous game. Drawing nearer, she spies two researchers, a couple of vagabond scientists from that loose confederation who gather every summer in the flimsy trailers full of lab gear in a clearing a handful of miles from her own cabin. She dreads these run-ins with her old tribe. She always says as little as possible. Today she holds back and watches. Through the woods, at this distance, the two men look like upright, blundering circus bears in lumberjack costumes. The pair bushwhack a little, closing in on a spot that interests them. One of the men hoots softly, a perfect purring impersonation. She has heard the call at night, although she has never seen the caller. This imitation would fool her. The man calls again. Incredibly, something answers. A duet ensues. The bright, pert, human come-on, followed by the logy but obliging bird hidden in the trees. A streak in the air and the owl appears. Bird of wisdom and sorcerers. It's the first Strix occidentalis Patricia has ever seen. Spotted owl. The endangered species that scientists propose to save by locking up billions of dollars of old growth, the only place it can live. It settles down, mythic, on a branch 3 yards from its seducers. Bird and men regard each other. One species takes pictures. The other just spins its head and blinks its enormous eyes. Then the owl is gone, followed after further note-taking by the humans, leaving Patricia Westerford wondering if she wakes or sleeps. 3 weeks later, she's near the same spot, pulling invasive plants. The thick, furry twigs of ailanthus suckers leave her fingers stinking of coffee and peanut butter. She climbs a switchback at a good clip and runs into the two researchers again. They're several yards up the slope, kneeling by a downed log. Before she can flee, they see her and wave. Caught, she waves back and hikes up to them. The older man is on the ground, on his side, popping tiny creatures into specimen bottles. Ambrosia beetles? The two heads turn toward her, startled. Dead logs. The topic was her passion once, and she forgets herself.
When I was a student, my teacher told us that fallen trunks were nothing but obstacles and fire hazards.
The man on the ground looks up at her.
Mine said the same thing.
Clear them off to improve forest health.
Burn them out for safety and cleanliness. Above all, keep them out of streams.
Lay down the law and get the stagnant place producing again.
All three of them chuckle. But the chuckle is like pressing on a wound. Improve forest health. As if forests were waiting all these 400 million years for us newcomers to come cure them. Science in the service of willful blindness. How could so many smart people have missed the obvious? A person has only to look to see that dead logs are far more alive than living ones. But the senses never have much chance against the power of doctrine.
Well, the man on the ground says, I'm sticking it to the old bastard now.
Patricia smiles, hope pushing through the ache like a breeze through rain.
What are you studying?
Fungi, arthropods, reptiles, amphibians, small mammals, frass, webs, denning, soil, everything we can catch a dead log doing.
How long have you been at it?
The two men trade looks. The younger man hands down another sample bottle.
We're 6 years in.
6 years? in a field where most studies last a few months.
Where on earth did you find funding for that long?
We're planning to study this particular log until it's gone. She laughs again, a little wilder. A cedar trunk on the wet forest floor. Their grad students' great-great-great-grandchildren will have to finish the project. Science, in her absence, has gone as crazy as she always thought it should be.
You'll disappear long before it does.
The man on the ground sits up.
Best thing about studying the forest. You're dead by the time the future can blame you for missing the obvious.
He looks at her as if she, too, is worth researching.
Dr. Westerford?
She blinks, as baffled as any owl. Then she remembers her uniform badge on her chest for anybody to read. But that doctor, he could only have gotten that from her buried past.
I'm sorry, she says. I don't remember ever meeting you.
You haven't. I heard you talk years ago. Forest Studies Conference in Columbus. Airborne signaling. I was so impressed. I ordered off-prints of your article.
That wasn't me, she wants to say. That was somebody else. Someone lying dead and rotting somewhere.
They hit you pretty hard.
She shrugs. The younger scientist looks on like a kid on a visit to the Smithsonian.
I knew you'd be vindicated.
Her bafflement is enough to tell him everything. Why she's in the uniform of a wilderness ranger.
Patricia, I'm Henry. This is Jason. Come visit the station.
His voice is soft but urgent, like there's something at stake.
You'll want to see what our group is doing. You'll want to learn what your work's been up to while you were gone.
By decade's end, Dr. Westerford makes her most surprising discovery of all. She may just love her fellow men. Not all of them, but robustly and with enduring green gratitude, at least those 36 regulars who take her in and make a home for her in the Dreyer Research Station, Franklin Experimental Forest, the Cascades, where she spends several dozen months in a row that are happier and more productive than she imagined possible. Henry Fallows, the group's senior scientist, puts her on a grant. Two other research teams from Corvallis add her to their payrolls. Money is tight, but they give her a mildewed trailer in the ghetto in the meadow and access to the mobile lab. All the reagents and pipettes she needs. The latrines and the community showers are sinful indulgences compared to her BLM cabin with its frigid sponge baths on the porch at night. Then there's cooked food in the shared mess hall, although some days she's so immersed in work that someone must come remind her that it's time to eat again. Her public reputation, like Demeter's daughter, crawls back up from the underworld. A scattering of scientific papers vindicates her original work in airborne semaphores. Young researchers find supporting evidence in species after species. Acacias alert other acacias to prowling giraffes. Willows, poplars, alders, all are caught warning each other of insect invasion across the open air. It makes no difference, her rehabilitation. She doesn't much care what happens outside this forest. All the world she needs is here, under this canopy, the densest biomass anywhere on earth. Steep, steely streams scour through ripples of rock where salmon spawn, water cold enough to kill all pain. Falls flash over ridges turned jade by moss and tumbled with shed branches. In the scattered openings, shot here and there through the understory, sit secret congregations of salmonberry, elderberry, huckleberry, snowberry, devil's club, ocean spray, and kinnikinick. Great straight conifer monoliths, 15 stories high and a car length thick, hold a roof above all. The air around her resounds with the noise of life getting on with it. Chibi of invisible winter wrens. Industrial pock from jackhammering woodpeckers. Warbler buzz. Thrush flutter. The scatterings of beeping grouse across the forest floor. At night, the cool hoot of owls chills her blood. And always, the tree frog's song of eternity. Through this Eden, her colleagues' astonishing discoveries confirm her suspicions. Slow, long observation makes a laughingstock of what people think about trees. In a nutshell, the rich brown batter of soil, itself mostly unknown microbes and invertebrates, perhaps a million species, channels decay and builds on death in ways she only now begins to suss out. It thrills her to sit at meals and be part of the laughter and shared data, the dizzy network trading in discoveries. The whole group of them, looking. Birders, geologists, microbiologists, ecologists, evolutionary zoologists, soil experts, high priests of water. Each of them knows innumerable minute local truths. Some work on projects designed to run for 200 years or more. Some are straight out of Ovid, humans on their way to turning into greener things. Together, they form one great symbiotic association, like the ones they study. Turns out that the temperate jungle's million invisible tangled loops need every kind of death-brokering intermediary to keep the circuits coursing. Clean up such a system, and the countless self-replenishing wells run dry. This gospel of new forestry is confirmed by the most wonderful findings. Beards of lichen high in the air that grow only on the oldest trees and inject essential nitrogen back into the living system. Subterranean voles that feed on truffles and spread the spores of angel fungi across the forest floor. Fungi that infuse into the roots of trees in partnerships so tight it's hard to say where one organism leaves off and the other begins. Hulking conifers that sprout adventitious roots high in the canopy that dip back down to feed on the mats of soil accumulating in the V's of their own branches. Patricia gives herself to Douglas firs. Arrow straight, untapering, soaring up 100 feet before the first branch. They're an ecosystem unto themselves, hosting more than 1,000 species of invertebrates. Framer of cities, king of industrial trees, that tree without which America would have been a very different proposition. Her favorite individuals stand scattered near the station. She can find them by headlamp. The largest of them must be 6 centuries old. He's so tall, so near the upper limits imposed by gravity, that it takes 1.5 days for him to lift water from his roots to the highest of his 65 million needles. And every branch smells of deliverance. The things she catches Doug Furs doing over the course of these years fill her with joy. When the lateral roots of 2 Douglas firs run into each other underground, they fuse. Through those self-grafted knots, the 2 trees join their vascular systems together and become one. Networked together underground by countless thousands of miles of living fungal threads, her trees feed and heal each other, keep their young and sick alive, pool their resources and metabolites into community chests. It will take years for the picture to emerge. There will be findings, unbelievable truths confirmed by a spreading worldwide web of researchers in Canada, Europe, Asia, all happily swapping data through faster and better channels. Her trees are far more social than even Patricia suspected. There are no individuals. There aren't even separate species. Everything in the forest is the forest. Competition is not separable from endless flavors of cooperation. Trees fight no more than do the leaves on a single tree. It seems most of nature isn't red in tooth and claw after all. For one, those species at the base of the living pyramid have neither teeth nor talons. But if trees share their storehouses, then every drop of red must float on a sea of green. The men want her to come back to Corvallis and teach.
I'm not good enough. I don't really know anything yet.
That doesn't stop us.
But Henry Fallows tells her to think about it.
Let's talk when you're ready.
The research station manager, Dennis Ward, drops by with little gifts when he's on site. Wasps' nests, insect galls, pretty stones polished by the creeks. Their standing arrangement reminds Patricia of the one she had with the pack rat she shared her BLM cabin with. Regular visits, lightning and shy, trading in worthless trinkets. Then, days of hiding. And just as Patricia once warmed to her resident pack rat, so she grows fond of this gentle, slow-moving man. Dennis brings her dinner one night. It's an act of pure foraging. Mushroom hazel casserole, with bread he has baked in a cloche laid in a brush burn. Tonight's conversation is not inspired. It rarely is, and she's grateful enough for that.
How are the trees? He asks, as he always does.
She tells him what she can, minus the biochemistry.
Walk?
He asks, when they finish rinsing the dishes into a gray water catch. A favorite question, to which she always answers, Walk! He must be 10 years older. She knows nothing about him and doesn't ask. They talk only of work, her slow research into the roots of Douglas firs, his impossible job of corralling scientists and getting them to abide by the minimal rules. She herself is well into autumn, 46, older than her father was when he died. All her flowers have long since faded, but here's the bee. They don't go far. They can't. The clearing is small, and the trails are too dark to navigate. But they don't need to go far to be in the thick of all she loves. Out into the rot, the decay, the snags, the luxuriant prolific dying all around them, where a terrible green rises, riding forth in all directions with its converting coils.
You're a happy woman, Dennis says, somewhere in that great basin between question and claim.
I am now.
You like everyone who works here. That's remarkable.
It's easy to like people who take plants seriously.
But she likes Dennis, too. In his spare motions and abundant silence, he blurs the line between those nearly identical molecules, chlorophyll and hemoglobin.
You're self-reliant, like your trees.
But that's just it, Dennis. They aren't self-reliant. Everything out here is cutting deals with everything else.
That's what I think, too.
She laughs at the purity of his hunch.
But you have your routines. You have your work. It keeps you going full time.
She says nothing, spooked now. On the threshold of a contented middle age. This ambush. He feels her clench. For the length of several owl calls, He adds no syllable. Then, here's the thing. It's nice to cook for you. She sighs long and slides down into the way things need to be.
It's good to be cooked for.
But everything is so much less spooky than she could have supposed. So much lighter. He says,
what if we kept our separate places and just came to each other from time to time?
That could happen.
Did our work, saw each other for dinner. Like now.
He sounds surprised to make the connection between his wild proposal and what the present already holds.
Yes.
She can't yet believe that luck might extend so far.
But I'd want to sign the papers.
He peers out into an opening in the western firs where the sun has undeniably started to set.
Because then, when I die, you could get the pension.
She takes his shaking hand in the dark. It feels good, like a root must feel, when it finds, after centuries, another root to pleach to underground. There are 100,000 species of love, separately invented, each more ingenious than the last, and every one of them keeps making things. Olivia Vandergriff. Snow is thigh-high, and the going slow. She plunges through drifts like a pack animal, Olivia Vandergriff, back to the boarding house on the edge of campus. Her last session ever of linear regression and time series models has finally ended. The carillon on the quad peals 5. But this close to the solstice, blackness closes around Olivia like midnight. Breath crusts her upper lip. She sucks it back in, and ice crystals coat her pharynx. The cold drives a metal filament up her nose. She could die out here for real, 5 blocks from home. The novelty thrills her. December of senior year. The semester so close to over. She might stumble now, fall face first, and still roll across the finish line. What's left? A short answer exam on survival analysis. Final paper in intermediate macroeconomics. 110 slide IDs in masterpieces of world art, her blow-off elective. 10 more days plus 1 more semester, and she's done forever. 3 years ago, she thought actuarial science was the same as accounting. When the counselor told her it dealt in the price and probability of uncertain events, the rigor, combined with ghoulishness, made her declare, "Yes, please." If life demanded a slavish commitment to one pursuit, there were worse things to commit to than calculating the cash value of death. Being one of 3 females in the program also gave her a little frisson, a kick to defy the odds. But the kick has long since gone limp. She's taken the National Society of Actuaries preliminary exam 3 times and failed all 3. Part of the problem is aptitude. Part is the sex, drugs, and all-night parties. She'll get the degree. She can still manage that. If not, she'll sample whatever opportunities disaster presents. Disaster is, as actuarial science proves and Olivia reassures her overly concerned friends, just another number. She turns the corner onto Cedar in the half-dark. Other students, stumbling under the weight of their own backpacks, have beaten trails through the snow, clumping around the first walker's mostly terrible guesses. Beneath the fresh drifts, cracked sidewalks ride up over bulging tree roots in the world's slowest seismic waves. She looks up, Although she'll miss precious little when she leaves this shit-kicking backwater, she does love the street lamps. Their Gilded Age, cream-colored globes look like stilled candles. They light a soft path through the student rentals all the way to her own rambling American Gothic, once some surgeon's mansion, now chopped up into private cubbies with 5 separate fire escapes and 8 mailboxes. Lit by the street lamp in front of her house is a singular tree that once covered the earth. A living fossil, one of the oldest, strangest things that ever learned the secret of wood. A tree with sperm that must swim through droplets to fertilize the ovule. Its leaves vary as much as human faces. Its limbs, in the streetlight, have that extraordinary profile, lined with bizarre short side spurs that make the tree unmistakable, even in winter. She has lived under the tree for a whole semester and doesn't know it's there. She passes it again tonight without seeing. She stumbles up the snowy steps into a dark hall full of bicycles. She shuts the front door behind her, but frigid air keeps pouring through around the seams. The light switch teases her from across the foyer. 6 steps into the black gauntlet, Olivia slits her ankle on a derailleur. Her curses echo up the stairs. She has raged against the bikes at house meetings all semester long. But here the bikes are, despite all the house votes, her frozen ankle gouged and smeared with bike grease, and her enraged sense of justice shouting, "Shit, shit, shit!" Nothing matters. 5 little months, and life will begin. Even if she's still living in rented squalor in a cold water apartment over a breakfast dive where she waitresses, all the forthcoming crimes and misdemeanors will be gloriously hers alone. Someone snickers at the top of the stairs. "Everything all right?" Suppressed giggles seep down from the kitchen. Her housemates, entertained by her routine rage.
"Just fine," she chirps.
Home. December 12, 1989. The Berlin Wall coming down. From the Baltic to the Balkans, millions of oppressed people take to the winter streets. Her scraped-open ankle spills blood through the foyer. So what? She bends to press a dry Kleenex to her wound, stanching the flow. It stings like mad. Hugs await her above. 2 routine, 1 mocking, 1 cold, and 1 filled with half a year of hangdog longing. She hates her housemates' endless cheap hugging, but she hugs them back in kind. The group converged the previous spring in an orgy of mutual enthusiasm. By the end of September, the communal love fest spun out into daily recrimination.
"Whose hairs are these in my razor? Somebody stole the thimble of hash I left in the freezer. Who the hell stuffed that leftover turkey log down the disposal?"
But a girl can do anything with the finish line in sight. The kitchen smells like heaven, though no one invites her to share the meal. She checks the refrigerator. The prospects are abysmal. She hasn't eaten for 10 hours, but she decides to hold out a little longer. If she can wait to eat until after her private party, eating will be like dancing with demigods.
"Got divorced today," she announces.
Scattered cheers and clapping. "Took you long enough," says the least favorite of her former soulmates.
"True. Been getting divorced for longer than I was married."
"Don't change your name back. This one's much better."
"What were you thinking, anyway, getting married?"
"That ankle looks bad. You should at least clean off the grease." Another round of stifled giggles.
"Love you guys, too."
Olivia steals a bottle of somebody's nut brown ale, the only thing in the refrigerator not rancid, and squirrels it away into her rehabbed attic room. There, in bed, she knocks back the contents of the bottle without lifting her head. Acquired talent. grease and blood from her ankle, smear the bedspread. She and Davy met in court one last time that afternoon, between her econ and linear analysis. Now they're done, and the final decree has no power to sadden her further. She does have her regrets, tying her life to another's, a whim of sophomore spring, felt so all-in, so sweeping and innocent. For 2 years their parents raged at the idiocy. Their friends never understood, but she and Davy were determined to prove everyone wrong. They did love each other, in their way, even if their way consisted mostly of getting high, reading Rumi out loud, then screwing each other senseless. But marriage turned them both abusive. After the third time through the funhouse werewolf act, which ended up with her fracturing her fifth metacarpal, somebody had to sober up and pull the plug. They had no property to speak of, and no kids except the two of them. The divorce should have taken a day and a half. That it took more than 10 months was mostly a function of nostalgic lust on the part of both litigants. Olivia sets the empty beer on the radiator with the other dead recruits and fishes in the nest of crap by her bed until she finds her disc player. Divorce requires a memorial service. Marriage was her adventure, and she needs to commemorate. Davy kept the roomie, but she still has scads of their favorite trance music, and dope enough to turn the regrets into laughs sufficient for today. There's her linear analysis final to worry about, of course, but that's still 3 days off, and she always studies better when a little loose. It should have occurred to her 2 years ago, even in the initial thrill, that any relationship where she lied 3 times in the first 2 hours might not be a great long-term bet. They walked under the cherry blossoms in the campus arboretum. She professed a deep love for all flowering things, which was a flavor of true, at least right then. She told him that her father was a human rights lawyer, again, not entirely false, and that her mother was a writer, which was pretty much bullshit, though based on a fact-like scenario. She isn't ashamed of her parents. In fact, she once got suspended from grade school for punching a chick who called her father flaccid. But in the world of satisfying stories, her preferred domain, both of Olivia's parents are so much less than they should have been. So she spruced them up a tad for the man she'd already decided she would spend the rest of her life with. Davy lied, too. He claimed he didn't need to graduate, that he'd done so well on the civil service exam, the State Department had offered him a job. The fib was outrageous enough to be kind of beautiful. She did have a thing for fantasists. Later, under the cherry blossom snow, he'd flashed her the little Victorian tin with the mustache wax ad on the top and the 6 long, thin bullets of weed inside. She'd never seen anything like it, except in high school anti-drug films. And soon enough, she was sold on the fine art of hang-gliding above the busy earth. So began her still-unfolding romance with a gift that kept on giving, a romance that, unlike the one with Davy, was sure to last a lifetime. She cues up the trance playlist, sits in her beloved window seat, opens the sash to the frigid night, and blows puffs of smoke onto the death-trap fire escape. The phone rings, but she doesn't pick up. It's one of 3 men whose beliefs about her logistics she can no longer keep straight. The phone rings on. She has no answering machine. Who would use a device that leaves you responsible for calling someone back? She counts the rings, a kind of meditation. 12 summons, while she blows 2 fat puffs of hash cloud into the frozen outdoors. The crazed persistence narrows down the caller until she knows. It can only be her ex checking in, hoping to mark the occasion with one last loving brawl.